Maseches Chulin is the third Masechta in the Seder of Kodshim. It's interesting to note we've gone through Zvachim talking about various issues in Karbonos, and then we went through Menachos talking about the Korban Mincha, and now we're talking about Chulin, which is not related to the Beis HaMikdash or bringing Karbonos. Literally, Chulin means ordinary or profane, and we're going to talk about Shechita not inside the Beis HaMikdash. In fact, it's quite a long Masech, that's 12 different prakim. Only the first two prakim will deal with Shechita per se, and all the other prakim will have different topics. Each one has its own topic, very interesting. So each will have its own topic as it relates to ordinary non-Beis HaMikdash animals. When it comes to the Shechita, as we will see in various places, and particularly in the first two prakim, for a kosher shechita on an animal, the requirement is that you have to cut through both of the windpipe and the food pipe. The windpipe is called the kaneh, the trachea, that's the windpipe, and the veshet is the food pipe. You have to cut through the majority of each of them in order to have a kosher shechita on an animal. And when it comes to shechita on a board, on a deoraisa level, you only have to cut through the majority of one of the two, not both of them. When it comes to shechita, as we'll see in various places in the first two prakim, there are various psulim that were taught as a halacha lemoshe misina. We're not going to go through all of them. There are actually five of them, but we'll just mention one or two of them. So what will be important at the beginning of when we start out, but really all of them will be referenced, is shechia. Shechia means that when somebody is doing the shechita, he pauses during the shechita. So he takes a little bit of a break. That would be a halacha lemoshe misina, a psul, an invalidation of the shechita. And various other ones are the drasa, which means instead of going in a movement back and forth with the knife, the person who's doing the shechita, the shochet, presses the knife. So you're really using force instead of the movement back and forth. So those are two of the five, and we will, Amir Hashem, get to others as we go through. We're going to start, obviously, in the first parak, Mishnah Aleph, and we will be talking about two variables. Number one is who can do the shechita, who can and who cannot do the shechita, and at what time during the day and what days of the year can the shechita be done, when can it not be done. So that's going to be Mishnah Aleph. So as follows, HaKol Shochtin U'Shechita San Kshera. This seems like a simple statement that everyone can shecht and all of their shechita is kosher, but the Gemara really dices this up and explains that there's a somewhat of a conflict in this language here. It says HaKol Shochtin, and that's the language as Lechatchila. Everyone is lechatchila allowed to shecht, u'shechita san kshera is, and the shechita is kosher on a bidyevel level, after the fact, but not lechatchila. So the Gemara explains this as follows, what's going on. Hakol shochatin means anyone who knows the halachas of shechita, even though we haven't seen him shecht three times, he doesn't have a chazaka by us that he's a good shochet, as long as somebody knows the halachas of shechita, their shechita will be kosher on a lechatchila basis. However, if we haven't checked into this individual, we don't know that he knows the halacha of shechita, he shouldn't shecht. But if he did shecht, his shechita is going to be kosher, even if we, after the fact, give him a test and it turns out that he does know the halachas of shechita. So that's why the language that's kol shochtin lechatchila, anyone who knows the halachas can shecht, u'shechita san kshera, and if you didn't check him before, you didn't test him before, but only after he did the shechita and he knew the halachas there afterward, still his shechita is going to be kosher. Chutz, with the exception of mecheresh shote v'katan, these three categories, the cheresh is a deaf mute, somebody who cannot hear, cannot speak, a shota, somebody who's insane, and a katan, somebody below the age of bar mitzvah, they are not going to be able to do the shechita, even if they know the halachas of shechita, it doesn't matter, they cannot do the shechita. Why? Shema yikalkalu b'shechitas, and because they may ruin the shechita. They may, as we have the five psulim, they may take a break during the shechita, they may tear out the kana and veshet instead of cutting them properly. So we're not going to take a chance with these three, so they should not do the shechita. However, even when it comes to these three, v'chulam sheshachtu v'chayrim ro'inosan, even if we have a chayr shotav and a katan, they did the shechita as long as they knew the halachas and somebody else was watching them. It doesn't have to be that the chayr shotav and the katan know the halachas, the person watching them has to know the halakas. There was supervision there. Accordingly, shechita sangsher, that will be a kosher shechita. On the other hand, we have a category that of person that is not going to be kosher, even b'dieved. Even if you have somebody who knows all the halachas, is being supervised by somebody who knows all the halachas, it's not going to be kosher shechitas nachri when it comes to the shechita of a non-Jew. A non-Jew, based on the pasuk, is not in the parsha at all of shechita, because they don't have to eat meat that's been shechted. Accordingly, if the non-Jew did shechita, that meat will be a nevela. Nevela is non-kosher, even if it's a kosher animal, but did not have a kosher shechita. It is a nevela. It's a carcass. It cannot be eaten. And a specific halacha when it comes to the nevela of tuma and tahara, umetama b'masa. It indeed will cause a certain type of tuma, a nevela, that if somebody carries it, even if he or she does not touch it, but carries it, it will be tuma, it will be tame, that is called tumas masa. And continuing, that has been all talking about who can do the shechita, when can they do the shechita, ha-shochet balayla, if somebody does shechita at night without having light, so it's talking about it's dark, v'chein hasuma sheshachat, somebody who is blind did the shechita, that is not the ideal way to do it. We're concerned if you did it at night, you may not see well. A suma certainly doesn't see well, doesn't see at all, a blind person. Nonetheless, shechita so kshera on a b'dieved level. This isn't lechatchila, on a b'dieved level, it will be kosher. Not ideal, but the halacha is at night is lechatchila if you have proper lighting. So even at night, if there's proper lighting, that's no problem. It's like doing it during the day. And in fact, if you do it during the day, but in a dark place, you do it in a dark cave, that's problematic as well. So we need light, whether it's in the day or the nighttime. Continuing, how about certain days that you can't do the shechita? So you can't do shechita on Shabbos and Yom Kippur. That is part of the Lamites Malachos. On Yontif, it would be permitted, but on Shabbos and Yom Kippur, prohibited. How about if somebody b'shogeg, by mistake, did a shechita on Shabbos or Yom Kippur? And that would mean that the person didn't know that it was prohibited to do shechita on Shabbos and Yom Kippur, even if they knew it was Shabbos and Yom Kippur, or alternatively, the person knew it was prohibited to do shechita on Shabbos and Yom Kippur, but didn't know it was Shabbos or didn't know it was Yom Kippur. So, ashochet b'Shabbos, somebody did shechita b'shogeg by mistake on Shabbos or uvi Yom Kippurim or on Yom Kippur. Af al pi shemischai b'nasha, even though doing shechita on Shabbos and Yom Kippur is one of the Lamites Malachos. And had it been done b'mezid, had the person known that it was prohibited, knew it was Shabbos, knew it was Yom Kippur, it was not a case of shogi b'mezid, the person would have been put to death. That is nonetheless, but the person here did it b'shogeg, then shechita sokshir, the shechita will be kosher. That doesn't mean you can eat it immediately on Shabbos. You have to wait until Motzei Shabbos or Motzei Yom Kippur, but it will be a valid shechita because it was done b'shogeg on Shabbos or Yom Kippur. Mishnah Beis discusses the halachas of what should a shechita be done with. Ideally, we'd have a special shechita knife that has to be a smooth-edged knife, and we'll see shortly that items that are sharp but serrated, so they have these sharp edges, even if they're small, that is not going to be kosher because that is not going to be a smooth cut. In order to do the shechita, it's going to be a tearing motion. So that's going to be principle number one that we're going to see is a serrated knife. Anything that is sharp like that, that has these grooves, will not be acceptable. We need something that's smooth. So that's going to be principle number one. Principle number two that we're going to see is if something that is attached to the ground, where it is naturally attached, for example, a stone that's attached to the ground, a tree, a reed, a sharp reed, as long as it's attached to the ground, it is going to be invalid as an implement also in order to do the shechita. And even if it's been detached and reattached on a rabbinic level, that is not going to be acceptable either. So those are some of the principles that we will hash out as we go through our Mishnah. So Mishnah Beis says as follows, Hashochet b'malgal yad, somebody who does a shechita with a hand sickle. What's a hand sickle? So this is very important for understanding this clause here of the Mishnah. A hand sickle is something that has two edges on it. On one side, it is smooth, so that would be kosher. But on the second side, it is serrated, which would not be kosher. And Chazal were concerned, if we let you use the smooth side of the hand sickle, you may make a mistake and use the serrated side. So it goes as follows, that would not be acceptable on a lechatchila basis, but bidyevit, if you use the smooth side of that hand sickle or the magal yad, it will be acceptable, it will be a kosher shchita bidyevit. So that is hashochet b'magal yad. Or he does the shchita bitzor, which is a sharp stone. So what's required for shchita is something that is sharp, not serrated. So that is a sharp stone, ubekaneh, and that is a sharp reed. Now here we're concerned, stones are typically attached to the ground, and a reed is typically attached to the ground. So that would be something that you cannot use even on a bedi'evid level. We are talking here about a sharp stone that was detached from the ground and reattached. If it's detached totally, or that sharp reed is detached from the ground, you can use it lechatchil as long as it's sharp, as long as it's not serrated. If it can do a good job on the shkita, lechatchila, you can use it. What we're talking about here, if it was reattached to the ground, Chazal were concerned then, so lechatchila, you should not use it. They're concerned that you may come to use that something that wasn't ever detached from the ground. If it was never detached from the ground, then you can't use it even bidyevit. So if somebody used this bitsor of a kaneh, somebody uses the sharp stone or uses the sharp reed, shchita sok shera, it's going to be kosher on a bidyevid level when we're talking about something that was detached and reattached. Continuing, we're going to recap a little bit of what we saw in the first Mishnah. Hakol shochtin, everyone can do shchita, unless we said they couldn't from the first Mishnah. But the default is everyone can do the shchita, ula olam shochtin, and you can do it at any time. Anytime, any place, not at night without light, that wouldn't be lechatchila, only bidyevit. But the default is you can do it anytime, any place, not Shabbos and Yom Kippur. But this is the general rule. Anyone can shecht. Anyone at any time can shecht. Lubakol shochtim, as long as it's a sharp blade, it's not serrated, you can shecht with any cutting implement. And now we're going to have the exceptions, chutz, and we're going to list four. Three of them are going to be in the same category for the same reasons, number one, two, and three. The number four is going to be for a different reason. So these are the exceptions that you cannot do shchita with. Chutz, magal katsir. This is a harvesting sickle. This actually has only one side of serration. And the problem here that is it's not a normal serrated knife. When we think about a normal serrated knife, their serrations go throughout the blade, evenly throughout the blade. Here, the serrations point in one direction. So the teeth of this magal katsir, of this harvesting sickle, they point towards the handle. So they're pointing in one direction. So in other words, if you are going to use the serrations, then it is going to be a totally invalid shchita. But if you're going to use it in the opposite direction, not using the serrations, but using the knife going away from you, then you're only going to use it in a smooth way. You're not going to use the serrations. Then mi'ikar adin, it should be acceptable. So we're going to see that in a little bit. So it goes as follows. Chutz mi'magal katsir, you can use any sharp blade except, number one, a harvesting sickle, and number two, v'megira, a saw that has serrated, that has a serrated blade. It's not smooth. The hashinaim, and if you have teeth, what does that mean, teeth? So if you have a jawbone of an animal and it has its teeth, they're fairly sharp. You could think of using them for the shechita, but the problem is because they are separate teeth, albeit they are sharp, they are like a serration, so they cannot be used. Because if you use that as the shechita, if you use this harvesting sickle in the wrong direction, if you use the saw or use the teeth of that jawbone, you are going to be using effectively a serrated knife, a serrated blade, then that's going to invalidate the shechita. And number four is a hatziporen, or if you use a nail, in other words, your nail that grew out and is sharp, you cannot use that. Now, the reason for the nail is that that is considered to be mechubra. That's considered to be attached. Just like you cannot use something that's attached to the ground, you can't use something that is attached to your body. So the Mishnah is now going to bring the reasons for number one, two, and three. Mibnei shen chonkim. You can't use that harvesting sickle. You can't use the saw. You can't use the teeth because they tear. When you use them for shchita, it's not going to be a smooth blade. Serrated, the problem with the serration, it's a tearing motion that invalidates the shchita and the tziporen. When it comes to the nail, that's for a different reason because it's considered attached to the body. That's like something that's attached to the ground. That would be invalid. And now continuing, getting back to hashochet, b'magal katsir b'derech achli chasa. So how about if I take that harvesting sickle? And what we said before is that the serrations are pointing towards the person's hand. So indeed, if the person would use that sickle by pulling it towards himself, then the teeth will be used. He's using the serration, and he's tearing instead of cutting smoothly with the shechit. However, if he uses it in the direction away from himself, then that would make a smooth cut. So the Mishnah says as follows, indeed, if you do cut it in a proper way, in the forward motion away from yourself, so you're not using the serrations, Beis Shammai says it is puzzle, it's invalid, Beis Hillel Machshir, and Beis Hillel says it's going to be kosher. Now, it's not what it seems to be that Beis Hillel is saying that it's a kosher shechita. That's not what it's saying. Both Beis Shammai and Beis Hillel agree that it's not a kosher shechita. The concern here is that you may pull it in a proper way away from you and not use the serration, but we have a gzeira, we're concerned. Chazal decree, don't do it in the direction away from you, even though that's using it smoothly, because you may easily come to use this sickle pulling it towards yourself, which is using the serration. So even Beis Hillel would agree that the shechita itself is not going to be kosher. The whole discussion here is if you use this magal katsir, use this harvesting sickle, will that animal be considered a nevela such that it causes there to be the tuma that we mentioned before, the tuma of somebody who carries it? So is that going to have that tuma or not? So Beis Shammai says this animal, because you shecht it with the harvesting sickle, it's going to be considered a nevela, and it's going to be mitamei b'masa. And Beis Hillel machshirin means that it's not going to be a kosher shechita. I agree with that, but it is not going to be a nevela such that it is going to be mitamei b'masa. And in any case, the Mishnah continues. We're seeing a lot of gzeiras here. Gzeira, you may make a mistake, and you may use it the serrated instead of the non-serrated, etc. If you take that magal katsir, that harvesting sickle, and you straighten out, you remove those serrations, and you make it into a smooth blade, you smooth out the serrations, it is going to be kosher then to be used just like a shechita knife. We're not concerned that still you took a harvesting sickle and you made it kosher. Maybe you're going to come to use a harvesting sickle that does have serrations. We're not concerned about that. The Mishnah here is saying that concern we're not going to have. We're not going to decree that. Once you remove the serrations, it is going to be kosher to be used as a shechita knife. Mishnah Gimel and thereafter Mishnah Dalet discuss the specific location where the shechita has to be on an animal. As we mentioned previously, there are five different psulim invalidations in shechita that were a halacha l'Moshe miSinai. One is called hagrama. Literally, it means when you cut beyond the area that the shechita should have been in. So we will discuss that in our Mishnah Gimel right now. Hashochet mitoch hatabas. If somebody shechted the top ring, what we're talking about here is the windpipe. As we mentioned previously, you're supposed to cut through to have a kosher shechita on an animal, the majority of both the windpipe and the food pipe. The way the windpipe is constructed by a Kadosh Baruch Hu, the anatomy, is that there are a bunch of cartilage rings that go up the windpipe, and the top one is the largest, and the shechita has to be done in the top one or below. Now, what happens if you do it a little bit above the top ring? That is pasul. However, what if you do it at the way top of that top ring? Is that going to be a problem or not? So before we get into the language, we'll just say it out loud outside, and then we'll get into the language of the Mishnah. It's going to be a machlokes. The first of the shitas is that you can cut it at the way top of the ring, of the top ring in the windpipe, but what you have to do is you have to leave a tiny amount, even the width of a hair, but it has to be all the way around, meaning you can't break above that hair. There always has to be still attached to the part of the windpipe that you're cutting that is going to remain attached to the top, to the head. There has to be at least the width of a hair in order to be a kosher shechita, and that has to go all the way around. The second shechita that we'll see is you don't have to leave that hair breadth or width all the way around, but it has to be on the majority of that top ring. So it goes as follows. Hashochet mitoch hatabas. Somebody who did the shechita on that, in that top, the highest ring, in the windpipe, v'shirba milo hachut al pnei kula, and the person did leave that hair breath all the way around that ring, that is going to be shechitas aksher. It's going to be a kosher shechita. Rabbi Yossi, Rabbi Yehuda Omer, he disagrees. He is even more makel. He says, melo hachut al pnei ruba, as long as you leave that width of a hair around the majority of that ring, that top ring, that is still going to be a kosher shechita. Mishnah Dalet continues discussing the location of the shechita. And what we're going to do is we're going to divide up the area of the neck into three zones. And one zone is going to be the front of the neck, really the throat. The second is going to be the back of the neck. And the third zone is going to be coming from the side. It's not in the front, not in the back, but coming from the side. And we're going to discuss where does shechita work. And we're also going to contrast that to melika. Melika is the quasi shechita that's done on a burnt offering when we have the Beis Hamikdash. And that is going to contrast greatly. That is not done with a knife. That's done with the fingernail, the thumbnail of the Kohen Gadol. But we're just going to focus on the location. And on a high level, what we'll see is that the shechita has to be done from the front, and the melika of a bird offering in the Beis Hamikdash has to be done from the back of the neck. So we're going to compare and contrast, dividing into those three zones. Mishnah Dalet says as follows. Zone number one we'll discuss, Hashochet min hatzadim. If somebody does the shechita from the side of the neck, not the front, not the back, from the side, shechita sokshir, it's going to be a kosher shechita. However, hamolek min hatzadim, if somebody did the melika of the Kohen and the Beis Hamikdash, did the melika on a bird offering from the side of the neck, melika sapsula, that is going to be an invalid melika. That is zone number one, from the sides, and shechita can be done from the side, melika cannot be done from the side. How about from the back of the neck? So we're moving to zone number two, hashochet min haor, if somebody does shechita from the back of the neck, shechita sapsula, the shechita is going to be invalid, because shechita has to be done from the front of the neck or the sides. Hamolek mina oref melika sokshir. However, if the melika is done from the back of the neck, that is going to be kosher, because the melika has to be done from the back. And zone number three, hashochet mina tzavar, if somebody does the shechita from the throat, that's the front of the neck, from the throat area, shechita sokshir, the shechita is going to be kosher. That is where the shechita ideally should be. Hamolek min hatzavar, ideally, because you could also do it on the side, not the back. So hashochet min hatzavar, shechita sokshir, if you do the shechita from the throat, the shechita is kosher. However, hamolek min hatzavar, if you do the melika from the throat, melika sapsula, the melika is going to be pasul. And now we're going to really give the principles here, shekol ha'oref kasha lemelika, the entire back of the neck is kosher to do the melika from. On the other hand, v'chol hatzavar kasha l'shchita, the entire throat, that's the front area, is going to be kosher for the shchita. And the bottom line here is nimtza kasher b'shchita pasul melika, where it is kosher to do the shchita, which is in front, that is going to be invalid for the melika, and the reverse is true as well. Kasha melika, the place that is going to be kosher for melika, that's in the back of the neck, that is going to be pasul l'shchita, that's going to be invalid for the shchita. Mishnah Hey and thereafter Mishnah Vav are going to veer from talking about the main theme of chulin, shchita, of animals, and we are going to simply follow up with a pattern in the Mishnah that we saw in the prior Mishnah. If something works for A, then it doesn't work for B, and if it works for B, it doesn't work for A. We're going to go through various halachas that simply fit the same pattern. So Mishnah is going to focus on the issue of bringing bird offerings to the Beis Hamikdash, and what's interesting, if you look, there are only two types of bird offerings that can be brought in the Beis Hamikdash, and the psukim refer to them as torim, which is a turtle dove, and B'nei Yonah. Yonah is a pigeon, but it's referred to as B'nei Yonah, which implies a young pigeon. And we're going to see here that when you bring a turtle dove, it actually has to be a mature bird, not a young bird. A young turtle dove will not be kosher. And when it comes to the Yonah pigeon, it has to literally be a B'nei Yonah, young child pigeon. That's why it's B'nei Yonah and not a mature bird, so that they're the reverse there, when one has to be old and one has to be young. So that's going to be the pattern. Mishnah Hey says as follows, kasher b'torim, something that works, that's kosher for the tor, which is the turtle dove, which means it has to be an adult, it has to be in its mature phase. Pasul b'bnei yonah, that is going to be invalid for a b'nei yonah, because it can't be a yonah, it can't be a pigeon, it has to be a young pigeon. and the reverse as well. Kasher b'bnei Yonah, what is kosher b'nei Yonah, that the b'nei Yonah, the pigeon, has to be young, that's going to be possible b'torim, that is going to be invalid for the Torah, because that has to be more mature. Now, in fact, there are three stages that we're going to divide up into, not just young and old, but there's going to be an intermediate phase, a middle stage, and we'll see shortly that at that point, the bird's feathers, and talking about the feathers of the neck, begin to turn yellow. So that would be like the adolescence phase, the middle phase of the development. So tchilas hatzihuv baze ubaze pasul, when it comes to that intermediate phase of the yellowing of the feathers of the neck, that is going to be invalid for both the turtle doves and the pigeons. So bottom line here is that the pigeons have to be young, b'nei Yonah, young. The turtle doves have to be older and mature, but neither can be in that intermediate phase. Mishnah Vav continues our pattern with five different unrelated halachas. The first one goes as follows. Kasher bapara, something that is kosher when it comes to the para aduma, the red heifer. The red heifer, in order to prepare it, requires shechita, pasul, be'egla. That is going to invalidate an egla arufa. That is a process when there is a dead body that is found between two towns. You have to bring a calf, and it is struck from its back, so it's hit from the back of its neck, so shechita is not going to be a valid option for the egla arufa. So again, kasher bapara, what's necessary for the para, which is shechita for the para duma, is going to invalidate the egla arufa, and the reverse is the truth as well. Kasher be'egla, that which is kosher for the egla arufa, that is arifa, chopping from the back of the neck, is going to invalidate pasul bapara, will invalidate the para duma, which requires shechita. Number two, kasher b'kohanim, pasul b'levim, kasher b'levim, pasul b'kohanim. That which is kosher for kohanim, doing the avod and the mishkan, is going to be invalid for levim. And what this is talking about is there an age cap in excess of which that the kohanim or the levim cannot work. So when it comes to kohanim, they are not capped out in 50 years old. They can continue working thereafterward. However, in the mishkan, the Levim capped out at 50. They could not work in excess of 50. Also, another difference is if their voices are no longer good, when it comes to the Levim, they would be invalid to continue working in the base of Mikdash. However, that would be irrelevant for the Kohanim. Kasher b'Levim, pasul b'Kohanim. However, there are times that there will be a Kasher. Levim will be able to continue working, and that will those items will invalidate Kohanim. And that's talking about if the Kohen or the Levi is a Baal Mum, has a defect, a blemish, that will be Kasher B'Levim. A Levi can work even if he is a Baal Mum, can do his Avoda in the base of Mikdash and the Mishkan. However, when it comes to a Kohen, the Kohen is not allowed to do the Avoda in the base of Mikdash if he has a defect, a blemish. Continuing, Halacha number three in the same pattern. Tahor b'kli cheres, tamei b'kol hakelim. We are talking about different type of vessels, and the material that it's made of will dictate how it receives or does not receive tumah. And the big differential, distinction we're going to make here is between a kli cheres that is an earthenware vessel and other types of kelim. And the question that we're going to grapple with, if it's something that has a source of tumah, touches the outside of the kli, is that going to make the kli tameh or not? So the default is yes, that's tameh b'kol hakelim, that whenever you have a source of tumah on the outside, it's going to make the entire kli tamei. The exception is going to be the kli cheres, the earthenware vessel. It doesn't become tamei from the outside, only from the inside. So once again, as follows, this is the third example, third item that we're continuing in our pattern, tahor with kli cheres, something that is going to continue being tahor, not impure, will continue to be pure when it comes to an earthenware vessel, even if it's touched on the outside with something that is a source of tuma. That will be tamei b'kol hakelim. That will invalidate, that will be make impure the rest of the kelim being touched even on the outside. On the other hand, tahor b'kol hakelim, tamei b'kli cheres. There are times that when it comes to the other kelim, something, when it comes in certain type of contact with tuma, it will not be metamet, in contrast with a kli cheres, Acheres, that it will metame the earthenware vessel. I'm not talking about if the Tumah comes into its airspace but doesn't touch the Kli itself. So here we are going to be more lenient when it comes to other type of Kelim. Airspace is not enough. It has to touch it, either on the outside or the inside. But when it comes to a Kli Acheres, it is going to become Tame, even if the Tumah just entered the inside of its Kli, in the airspace of the Kli, didn't even touch it, it's still going to become Tame. Number four, Tahor B'Kli Eitz, Tame B'Kli Matachor. Now we're distinguishing between a Kli, or an item that's made of wood, and an item that is made of metal. And there's a halacha when it comes to wood, that if it doesn't have a kibul, a base kibul, it doesn't have a place to hold things, a receptacle, like a spoon or something like that. It's a pshute kliyetz, it's just a piece of wood, but it can't hold anything on the inside of it. Even if there's a source of tumah that touches it, it stays in its tahor state. So that's why it's tahor b'kli eitz. It's tahor if it's made out of eitz. However, if it's made of metal, even if it doesn't have a receptacle, it can't hold anything in it, it's just a simple piece of metal, that indeed will become tame. On the other hand, there are times that we're going to be stricter when it comes to wood, an item made of wood, than when it is made of metal. And it's as follows. If the item that's being made is not finished yet, it is functional, it can be used, but the completion of making that item it hasn't completed. So it's tahor b'kli matachos. If you have something tame that touches an unfinished kli that's made of metal, it will not be metameit. On the other hand, tame b'kli eitz, if it is an item that is made of wood, even though it's not finished, but as long as it can be used, if something that is tame touches it, indeed it will make it impure. And the last, number five, we are now talking about Trumas and Maestras, taking off the tithe. Truma goes to the Kohen. Maestras, Maestration, goes to the Levi. There are other tithes as well. And we're going to talk about almonds. And we're going to talk about almonds that there are two types, at least in our Mishnah, those that are bitter and those that are sweet. And an important rule is that you don't have to take off Trumas and Maestras from produce unless it is edible. So when it's edible, you have to take off Trumas and Maestras. When it's inedible, you don't have to take off Trumas and Maestras. And we're going to see the reverse stages when it comes to sweet and non-sweet, bitter almonds. And as follows, Hachayev Bishkedim Hamarim, when you are chayev to take off Trumas and Maestras from almonds when they are bitter. That's talking about when they are small, because even though they're bitter, they're edible when they're small, but they are not edible when they are large. It's inedible when it's large. So when we're talking about the type of shkedim almonds that are bitter, you only have to take off trumas and maestras when they're small. Potter b'metukim, when we're talking about sweet almonds, when they are small, sweet almonds are not edible whatsoever. So you don't have to take off the trumas and maestras. So when they're small, you take off trumas and maestras if it's bitter. If it's a sweet almond, you don't have to take it off. You don't take off Trumas and Maestras when it's small. However, the reverse is applicable as well. We're going to reverse it when it comes to when they're large. Hachayev b'metukim, when you're chayev to take off Trumas and Maestras, when we are talking about the sweet almonds, that's talking about when they are large. Sweet almonds become edible when they are large. So that's when the chiyuv of Trumas and Maestras kicks in. That is when it's going to be potter b'marim, when we are talking about the bitter ones. You're not going to have to take off Trumas and Maestras when they grow large, because they are no longer going to be edible. Mishnah Zayin is going to be similar to the theme that we saw in the prior Mishnah, but whereas we saw the Mishnah was comparing contrasting two separate items, in our Mishnah we are going to take a single item and we're going to contrast it at two different points in its life cycle. So we're going to actually go through five different items and compare the same item. Sometimes X applies, sometimes Y applies to that item. So we're going to start out, the first halacha that we will deal with is talking about hatemed. Temed comes up in various places in Shas, and what it is it's a low-grade, inferior quality wine, and what they would do is after making wine, they would take the leftover skins or the pulp and once again run water through it. So at the beginning of that process, when you do that, it's really water that has a little bit of a taste of grape in it. So that has the halachic status of water before it actually ferments. So hatemed atshelo hechmitz, when you have temed, that water that is colored or tasted somewhat a little bit like grapes, it's still considered water. So before it ferments and becomes wine, eino nikach bekesef meiser, it's not permitted to use your meiser sheni funds. If somebody had meiser sheni produce and redeemed it for money, brought the money, you're supposed to spend that money in Yerushalayim on food items. It can be food, it can be drink items, but not water. Water is not considered a food or drink item. So accordingly, if it's just temed before it ferments, you're not allowed to use your Meiser Sheni funds for it, because that would be meaning buying water with Meiser Sheni. You can't do that. And continuing, Oposel es hamikvah, and in addition, when it is temed before it ferments, it's water. If you would add it to a mikvah before that mikvah is full, a mikvah has to have 40 se'ah of water. So before it hit 40 se'ah, so it's not a kosher mikvah yet, the water is kosher, but you have to continue filling it up. If you add 3 lugin of what's called mayim she'uvim, it's not kosher rainwater, it's not kosher mikvah water. So if you would add temed, which is mayim she'uvim, because it's water and it's not the proper water that would come from rain, that would also invalidate that mikvah. So when it's in that temed phase before it ferments, it is water. So the two repercussions, two consequences of that is you can't use mice or sheni funds for it, and you also cannot add it to a mikvah if you're adding a minimum of 3 lugim. That would invalidate the mikvah. On the other hand, mishehichmitz, looking at the same item of temed, but once it ferments, so now it has become wine, or it may be an inferior quality of wine, but it still has become wine. So accordingly, now it is no longer considered water for both of those variables. Nikach bekesef meiser, now buying it in Yerushalayim, you can use your meiser sheni funds, and also veino posel es hamikvah, it also will not invalidate a mikvah. Water that is not good, mayim she'uvim, invalidates a mikvah, but wine and other such liquids do not invalidate a mikvah, even when it's added before you have 40 se'ah of kosher water in that mikvah. When it comes to the second halacha, this is going to be actually a little bit complicated. We are now going to talk about a father who passes away and he leaves an estate. And we're going to look at 2 different phases, whether the estate was divided between the brothers or it was not divided between the brothers. And there are going to be ramifications for 2 different halachas as well. So the first part of this is going to be ha'achim ha'shutafin, when we have 2 brothers, and this is talking about that they divided the estate and they repartnered. So they divided the assets and they repartnered together. So there are going to be 2 halachas that apply here. Kishechayavim bekalbon. There's a halacha, and we're going to Masechet Shkalim now, that whenever somebody gives the annual requirement of a half shekel, there was a requirement to add a small, very small coin in addition, called a kalbon. The reason for that is they were concerned the machatis shekel, the hefa shekel, maybe it was missing a little bit of its silver, so you had to make that up and add a kalbon as well. Then there was a halacha, number of halachas, but we're not going to go through everything, obviously. But there was a halacha that if you give a machatis shekel for somebody else as a gift, then you don't have to add that kalbon as well. So if we have these 2 brothers, they repartnered, and they're going to give each of their independent shkalim, each gives a machatis shekel, kishechayavim bekalbon, you're going to still have to give a kalbon. We'll just read the Bar Tanur real quickly. When they give their shkalim, evim shnei chetzi shkalim, so they bring together, they each are going to give, either they bring separately or together, but each has to give a half a shekel, each of them would be required to add a kalbon. So 2 kalbonas would have to be given. Now there's another halacha when it comes to partners. Partners do not have to give meiser behema. That's the annual tithe of new animals that were added to one's flock. If an animal is owned by an individual, you have to give meiser behema, and partners do not have to give. So in this situation, where we had the 2 brothers, they divided the estate of their father, and then they repartnered together, so they're going to be chayavim, they're going to have to give this kolbon, or each of them is going to have to give a kolbon when they give their shkalim. However, they are pturim in meiser behema because they are partners. Partners do not have to give the annual meiser behema. And the reverse is going to be the opposite case, kishechayavim b'meiser behema. So the situation here is that they have not divided the estate yet. If they haven't divided the estate yet, it's looked at as if the father owns the estate still, and at least for purposes of the shkalim. The purposes of the shkalim, so if you give a gift to someone, you pay for somebody's machatzis shekel, you don't have to give the kalbon. So here, it's effectively, if the estate is paying for the shkalim, the estate does not have to add that additional kalbon. However, because the estate is not a partnership, the brothers did not divide the asset yet, there would be an obligation to give ma'aser be'ema. So in this situation where they did not divide the estate yet, they have the assets together as it was owned by the father, k'she'chayvim b'ma'aser be'ema, because it's not a partnership, it's owned by the estate, effectively by the partner, they would have to, there would be an obligation of ma'aser be'ema, p'turim minam al kalbon. There would be no obligation to give the kalbon when the estate pays for the brothers machatis hashekel. Third halacha, kol makom shiyesh mecher. This is talking about when a father has a right, certain rights with respect to his daughter. It's talking about the right that he has to effectively sell her as a ama ha'ivriya, that's a maidservant for 6 years. So the father has the right to do that when she is a katana, but not when she is a na'ara. What is a katana? What's a na'ara? Katana is up until 12 years old. When she gets 12 years old and she shows signs of maturity, then she reverts to having the halachic status as a na'ara. A na'ara is from 12 till 12 and a half. So, komakam shiyesh mecher, anytime that she is a ketana, she's below 12 years, so the father has a right to sell her as an ama ha'ivriya, ein knas. If a man would come and, rachmana litzlan, violate a woman or seduce her, the Torah tells us that if she is a na'ara, if she is between 12 and 12 and a half and has showed signs of maturity, the person would have to pay a knas, a penalty of 50 shekel. So when there is, komakam shiyesh mecher, when the father has the ability to sell her as an ama ha'ivriya, because she's a katana and knas, there is no requirement if a man would violate or seduce her to pay that knas. Obviously, it's usur, it's a terrible thing, and he would be punished, but there is not going to be that payment because she is a katana, and that payment only applies if she is a na'ara, v'chomakam she is knas. On the other hand, when we have the same girl that we're talking about, but she is a different age, so when she is a na'ara, between 12 and 12 and a half, there is going to be that knas if the man violates or seduces her. So there is going to be ein mecher because she's already a na'ara. The father does not have the ability to sell her as an ama ivria. That only applies when she is a katana, not a na'ara. Number four, kol makom shiyesh meyun. This is talking about a girl who is married off. Now, the halacha of the Torah, a father does have a right to marry off his daughter when she is a katana, before she hits 12. The father has the right to do that, she is a katana. But other relatives, midoraisa, from the Torah, don't have that ability of al chazal. But however, chazal, the rabbis, instituted that other family members, like the mother, the brother, they can marry her off. Now, because it's only a derabbanan marriage, if a relative other than the father does it, she has the ability to refuse. And she has to do that refusal without a get. Without a get, she just simply has to say, I don't want this guy, I don't want to be married to him, I don't want to continue in this relationship. She is no longer married, doesn't need a get. She has to do that while she is a katana, not once she hits the age of 12, and at 12 is a na'ara. So the Mishnah says, kol makom shiyesh miyun, and any time that there is the ability for her to refuse, that's talking about when she is a katana, ein chalitza. Chalitza is the concept that if a man dies without children, that his wife will then fall to one of his brothers, and they will have the decision to make together whether they will do yibum, which is the levirate marriage, or chalitza, which acts as a gift that lets her go and she can marry somebody else. So that concept of chalitza, that if she's married and the husband passes away, that doesn't apply when she's a katana. She doesn't fall to chalitza, to one of his brothers. So again, kol makom shiyesh miyun, at any time that she has the ability to refuse when she was married off on a rabbinic level by a relative of hers other than the father, so she can simply opt out, refuse to stay in that relationship while she's a katana, ain chalitza, she will not have this concept of chalitza. If her husband passes away, she will not fall to chalitza, to one of his brothers. Or kol makom shiyesh chalitza, any time that she's now a na'ara. She is a na'ara, so this concept of chalitza does apply. A na'ara and older, so she would fall to chalitza if her husband passes away. Ein meyun, she can no longer refuse to stay in the relationship as a husband with the person that her relative non-father married her off to, she would require a get at this point because she's now a na'ara. And last halacha, we are now going to go to Masechah Shabbos, Komakam Sheishkia in Havdalah. We will explain this. This is the one of the five here, the last one that it goes into more detail on. So we'll just say the concept and then we'll get into the detail. It literally means any time that there is the blowing of the shofars, then ein havdalah. Then we do not say havdalah. On the other hand, v'chomakam sheyesh havdalah, any time that there is havdalah, ein tekiya, there's no blowing of the shofars. What does that mean? So we are talking about the situation of yuntif that falls on Friday. And on a typical Friday in the Beis HaMikdash, they had a set of shofar blasts that were announcing that Shabbos was coming. And the first one was to alert to people in the field that you have to come in from the field. And the second was to tell the people at the stores in the city, in the villages, you have to close up shop. And number three was for the people at home, telling them you need to wrap up the malach and the cooking that you're doing. And then right before Shkia, there were another three blasts close together, saying it's time for Shabbos. So our Mishnah is talking about not on a regular Erev Shabbos, but when Yontif falls on Erev Shabbos, it says there was also the blowing of the shofar. Yom Tov Shechaliyat Erev Shabbos, when we have a Yontif that falls on Friday, Tokin, there would be the Tekiya. We would still have to alert people because we're going from Yontif to Shabbos, and we have to alert them. On Yontif, you were permitted to cook. On Shabbos, you're not permitted to cook. So they did have the blowing of the shofars. However, v'lo mavdili, there is no havdalah when you go from a lower kedusha to a higher kedusha. We're not going to say a havdalah. That would be a slap in the face of the Shabbos, rachman alitzan. So we're not going to have a havdalah going from Yontif to Shabbos. Blow the shofars, but we don't say havdalah. We don't have a havdalah when we say kiddush. We don't have it in our davening. On the other hand, b'motzei Shabbos, when Yontif falls on Motzei Shabbos. So we went through Shabbos, and now Yontif, instead of being Erev Shabbos, is Motzei Shabbos. We're starting Yontif Saturday night. It's Sunday. That is going to be Yontif. So on Motzei Shabbos, mavdil, and we do have a havdalah. We do say havdalah, which we'll explain a little bit what the havdalah is. V'lo tokim. However, we don't have the tekiyas when we are going from Shabbos to Yontif. We don't have this concept of alerting people that you can start to do ochel nefesh, cooking for Yontif. We don't have that concept. We have to warn people when we go from a Yontif to a Shabbos that you have to stop cooking. We're not going to alert people that they can start cooking. And now we're going to explain what this means on Yontif that falls on Motzei Shabbos. Ketzan mavdilin, what's the Havdalah that we're talking about when we have Yontif that falls on Motzei Shabbos? So we have two opinions, Hamavdil ben Kodesh to Kodesh. What we're talking about is the bracha. We have the regular bracha of Havdalah that we say every Hamavdil ben Kodesh to Chom, Benokor Lechosh, Ben Yom We say all that nusach, the regular nusach, but at the end we say hamavdil ben kodesh l'kodesh, because we aren't going from kodesh l'chol. This is going from Shabbos to Yontif. So that's how we complete the bracha of Havdalah. Rabbi Dosa Omer ben kodesh chamor l'kodesh kakal. Rabbi Dosa says we have it a little bit more explicitly. We say we're going from the kodesh, the chamor, the strict kedusha of Shabbos, to the more lenient kedusha of Yontif. We do not paskin that way, because although that may be accurate, it would be a slight to Yontif, and accordingly we paskin that when we have Yontif that falls on Motzei Shabbos, we say Hamavdil Bein Kodesh Le Kodesh.